Session number 20456, Reel 16.
Brigadier Wilson, Reel 16.
A miscreant was marched in, escorted by two police, and everything went on in Arabic. I didn't know what happened. But after a bit, the sidebed recently got hold of this wonderful telephone and sort of rang the bell and put it up and started talking. And this miscreant absolutely went into a blue sweat. I mean, you were like, this sea chap, so frightened. And eventually the telephone conversation stopped. He was back. And the miscreant, you know, by now Jenny was, you know, marched out and started to cells. And I said, what was that about? And he said, well, he said, this chap is a known Jordanian thief and robber. We've got him. And, but I want a lot of information out of him. And so, on the telephone, which does not go anywhere, I, as far as he was concerned, was talking to the King of Jordan, who said, yes, we want this chap, we want to chop his head off as quickly as valuable can. And, so this was arranged by me, and I said, well, you know, I might just keep him for a couple more days. And he was so marvellous. He's talking, he said, you see, you British. He said, my family have been in Turkish, you know, government positions for generations. And he said, you British have no idea of how to deal with either the Arabs or the Jews. And he said, the Turks did. But he said, maybe wouldn't like to know what happened. But he said, it's not a question of injustice. They had very good justice. And he said, if someone was caught, you know, producing a bomb or shooting someone, they were properly tried. And he said, they were hung publicly outside the Damascus gate that afternoon. Mm. And he said women were sometimes worse than the men. He said if they were pregnant, he said, well, it's difficult to hang them. He said you waited till they had produced the baby. It might be a boy, and therefore it might serve them to take a shot, and then you hung them. So he said, how frightful. And he said, no. He said, look what you do. He said, you catch these guys red-handed. They're tried by a military court. They appeal to London, they appeal all over the place. 6 months later, they're hung privately in Acre jail, and they're heroes.
And they suffered more in the meantime, presumably.
Well, that's, you see, this is very interesting. And he said it's a question of different ways of dealing with different races. And he said, you think that you're being nice and just and fair to these people. He said, in fact, you're building yourself up more trouble.
You said in your memoirs, on reflection, you thought perhaps he was right.
Well, I'm so damn certain he was. I'm quite certain. Well, of course, in this day and age, with television and the newspapers, I'm not so sure now. But after all, these characters who smuggle drugs to Malaysia and Thailand get pretty short shrift. Mm.
It's certainly true that in some quarters there's a policy of quick and drastic punishment, which is intended to be deterrent. Do you think it would have been a deterrent?
Oh, by the time we were there, probably not.
Was it too late?
I think it was too late. You see, we'd lost the will. I mean, when you think of the things we did as deterrent after the Indian Mutiny, you couldn't get away with that nowadays.
I mean, veterans of the Arab Revolt, 1936-39, have said that on occasion, when they caught Arab fighters with weapons, they simply shot them because they felt that was the right thing to do, and that they felt it would be less humane to let them go through the process of trial, which after a prolonged period would eventually result in a hanging.
Yeah. Well, again, you're talking of a different world there without your instant television reporting and all the rest of it.
But this was only 8 years before.
I know, but think how maybe 8 years before, but if you think back to the goings on in the Falklands War with instant television of ships being up and so on, I think the whole business of deterrent has changed. For example, well, Bosnia, this latest one, you could not have, I don't think, an armed shootout under those circumstances. You can pretend to have a shootout, but you must not. There comes a limit as to what you can do. I think the Americans discovered that in Vietnam.
You do make mention of the press. Did you have the press with you all the time?
That
you
no.
were in Palestine?
No, we didn't. The press used. It rather depended on American foreign policy. If there was some great congressman who was getting up to make some impassioned speech about the British Empire, the Americans, after the war, were in a strange position. They did not want in any way to help the British Empire get back to what it was. And I don't blame them. And therefore, they really couldn't have cared less politically what they did or said. So if you had an incident in Palestine which was going to hit Congress, immediately a bevy of pressmen would come whizzing up from Cairo, you know, just to see what was going on.
How did you handle them? Did you have anyone at battalion headquarters who was designated to
no.
deal with the press?
That was a problem. I was not there when the press situation took, which resulted in the Squire Webb sacking took place. We should have done. And we were not briefed properly as to how to handle the press in those days. No way.
Was the press universally hostile, or were there some journalists who were favourable to you?
They were hostile. They just wanted to see what was going on. Well, the last thing you want if there's been a bomb exploded is to have the whole place surrounded with pressmen when you're trying to clear the area and so on. And you can see, I see exactly what happened to Squire Webb. He lost his temper. And he thought, right, you know, now is our chance. I'll bloody well lock the lot of you up. Well, of course, they missed all their dispatches of their papers, and that was the most frightful hour.
Was there anyone at brigade or divisional headquarters who was supposed to handle the press and brief them?
I don't think so, no. I don't think the first time I saw the press being handled or being briefed about the press was in Korea.
So there was a sea change then between
yes, there was.
What happened in Palestine and what happened in Korea. I think you were away at the time when the Squire made his error of judgment.
That's
because you were at the Staff College of Haifa.
Haifa, yes.
What were you doing there?
Well, if you remember, just about then, the Army decided that there would be an examination for places at the Staff College, and they used to run courses for people taking the exam. And they were running one such of these courses at Haifa. And having been at the Staff College myself, I was sent up there to lend a hand.
What sort of course was it that you sat
up? Well, it was almost a miniature Staff College course. Yeah. For example, we taught them about establishments, battle orders, tactical issues, so that when they got their papers, at least they had some idea of what they were going to be asked.
So it's a sort of preparatory course?
It was a entirely preparatory course, yes.
Now, there was the explosion, the press were locked up, they took their revenge, the colonel was sent home and you were suddenly elevated to the siege
perilous. Yes.
How did the battalion feel about the way in which the squire had been treated and sent home?
Well, they were hopping mad.
Who were they hopping mad with?
Well, everyone, you would think of. You saw that thing about the Saturday night, was it the Sicilian mutiny?
The Salerno mutiny.
Well, I mean, they were very like those guys. Why? You know, what have we done wrong? The answer is they'd done nothing wrong. But the answer is they had the misfortune to have a colonel who'd made a grave error of misjudgment.
Was there a change in policy concerning the press or such things after he'd left?
Oh, yes. I mean, we were then told, for goodness sake, you know, watch these boys. First of all, don't let them poke their noses in the places they shouldn't poke their noses. But on the other hand, in every other way, give them any help they want. Yeah. And that was difficult sometimes, because when you get people rushing around... I give you an example. In Korea, Battle of Taiwan, siege by the press at one stage, and there were a section of my mortars who were having a blatter at the enemy, and there was a guy with a camera that came up and said to one of the mortarmen just standing down the box, "Hold it, jock, for a minute while I get a good picture of you," you know. Perfectly harmless, really, but I mean, just the sort of thing you don't want.
A distraction.
Well, that's it, he said. Yeah, you know, you'll have a super picture in your local paper of you gallantly firing bombs at Koreans.
What did the jocks think of that?
Oh, they thought it was marvellous, you know. They thought that as well.
Eventually, I think you were told that there was going to be a reorganisation and the battalion was going back to... was going to the 3rd Division.
Yes.
How do they feel about leaving the Air Landing Brigade and going into the 3rd Division? Did they have any reaction to that news?
Yes and no. Well, in some ways, a bit of relief, because they were going to have a Christmas at the Canal Zone with, you know, all their release from fatigues, patrols and things that they would otherwise have come across. Yeah. There was no great... You see, we weren't part of the Air Landing Brigade during operations, so there was no great loyalty, as it was the other two battalions, to the Air Landing Brigade. They were just another brigade.
Did you carry out many operations in conjunction with the other two battalions?
Oh, yes. Mm. Very much so. They were... The Ulster Rifles on one side of Jerusalem, we were the other side. I mean, you know, we were held the thing in a vice, as it were.
Were they easy to get on with? Was the cooperation?
We have great friends with them.
And who are the 3rd Battalion, isn't they?
They are. You had the Ulster Rifles, Oxenbucks,
yes,
ourselves. And the Ulster Rifles and Oxenbucks were originally the Landing Brigade, and the 4th Devons were their 3rd Battalion, but being a territorial battalion, were not sent back out to the Far East, Middle East, rather.
How did you get on with the Oxenbucks? Were you on good terms with them?
Very well. Mm. They were all very great friends, you know. Mm. I mean, yes, there was that sad loss of leaving some chums behind, but never on that.
You say that when you were in Egypt, you did some field training, some exercises while you were there. What sort of operations were you practicing
those? Well, this was much more down to war again. We did a lot of exercises with our artillery regiment. Yeah. You know, with live shells and things, yes.
Was the emphasis mainly on the offensive, or was it on the defensive?
Well, everything.
All the poses.
One practiced officers and NCOs in directing artillery fire, one... You know, marched up behind barrages, one, you know, laid down. It was really to get us back from an internal security rail into a more sort of open country operational rail.
Did the soldiers prefer that kind of activity to what they've been doing earlier on?
Yeah, that's very difficult to say. What they did prefer, you see, was being in a nice camp with proper cookhouses and everything. And we had a whole, I think, company of German prisoners of war who did all sort of canteen fatigues and God knows what else. And they were very good.
Did you know where they were from? Who, you know,
no,
where they served?
I didn't. I think they were a mixture of Africa Corps. They mostly all ex-Africa Corps. They used to drive about in very smart, very well-kept British lorries with a little black diamond, a little Dachshund on the black diamond. That was our sign.
When you took over as battalion commander, stepping in,
yeah,
in place of the squire, did you change anything in
no.
the battalion in
no,
any radical way?
Didn't need to. Running as you know, I ran before I left them. There's no.
Would you say that the internal security operations were primarily a matter at company level, or were they? Was it really a battalion where the decisions were being made day to day and moment to moment?
It was an awful lot of them at company level, but they were very closely monitored by battalion. I had, in the Hospice Notre Dame, one of the rooms we did on the floor, a very accurate, painted on the floor, street map of Jerusalem with little model houses and things. And if we had patrols out or operations going, and we had a wireless set around the walls, one knew exactly where people were, and one, you know, were able to give orders reasonably effectively.
This presupposes that your wirelesses were working well.
Yes, by then we'd got them sorted out, yes.
So you've got reliable wireless communications?
We'd got pretty reliable wireless communications, yes.
How far down the line did that go? Could you go
well,
down
went,
the section?
Well, it went right down to platoons.
Platoon level.
Mm. Yeah. My humble staff car had two big sets. One set went to brigade. The other set went to all our companies. And the third set was a sort of operational set that could go on either the police net or our own sort of battalion operational net. Mm. So, I mean, it was quite well, reasonably worked out and worked pretty well.
Now, it sounds as though you got, in effect, what was a war room in the Notre Dame.
Indeed.
With your model of the
yeah.
sector.
Yeah.
Who would normally be in that
well, you'd have
war room?
There would be a duty officer on 24 hours with two duty signalers. And so that the battalion adjutant could get on with his own administrative business, you know, down below, various things he was doing, and not be bothered. And at night, we had 24-hour watches.
I was going to presumably most things that happened at night.
No, not necessarily. King David was by day, the Jerusalem railway station was by day. I'm trying to remember. Oh, yes, there was much more activity at night, more patrols out. Yeah.
Who would actually normally be the duty officer? Would it be company commanders
be any,
by
turn? No, would be any officer selected, having, you know, considered clued up enough to do it.
What would you be doing normally? Would you be in your
well, I was normally
war room
I could be in the war room, but much more normally, I was in my big Humber staff car with a small escort on the streets, sort of going around the pickets and things.
What, visiting and
what?
You'd be going around visiting, effectively.
Yes. Because I could control the thing perfectly well, because providing we were in touch with the war room.
Yes.
No,
did the other battalion have the same sort of setup for their controlling their operation?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Who actually did the work of painting the map of the streets on the floor? And
I had in wartime battalions highly trained artists and, you know, model makers and God knows what. They loved it, you know. They were in the intelligence section. Mm. They thought it was great fun.
How many men were there in your in section?
I think the strength of the battalion was between 700 and 800. Mm.
But what about the intelligence section? How many men were there in that?
A dozen? Mm. Yeah. One officer, one sergeant.
Did any of them speak Arabic or...?
Well, we're lucky we had one or two who spoke Arabic, Jewish. But basically speaking, their job was much more the collation of information rather than gathering it. Mm. I mean, no way would you send jocks down the calves on the streets. I think they've had their throats cut like before you knew where they were. That was entirely a police undercover business.
One of the things that's done in Northern Ireland is to give soldiers a sort of surveillance task if they're operating in areas that they know. So they're told to keep their eyes open for particular individuals or developments or anything out of the ordinary. And did you find that jocks were reporting in unusual?
Well, yes. I mean, that was one of the things one had to try and train them to do. Mm. Yeah. And they got accustomed to their districts. And if a shop suddenly closed or something, they would probably try and find out why.
So you were building up a picture of the community.
Yes.
It's operating.
Indeed.
Another thing that's said about internal security is that the principal enemy of the soldier on such duty is boredom, because a lot of the time they're in uncomfortable conditions and nothing is happening. Yeah. Could you organise any sort of entertainment or recreation when you were in Jerusalem earlier on?
Very little. The only thing was that being Jerusalem, there were lots of sort of calves and things, and off duty, the boys could go into them.
Mm. Presumably they had to take precautionary measures if they were going.
Well, they took their weapons with them. Mm. They were armed. Mm. And that led to problems. But that was one's trouble, you know. There was very little outside entertainment at all.
I mean, did you lose any as a result of men being attacked in cafes off duty or anything of that sort?
No. The only one big problem we had were two little thugs when it held up by the local Church of Scotland chapter and robbed him of his kit. And the jocks did not pray. They prayed to be sent to somewhere else very quickly.
Who were these fellows, bandits?
You saw it in the papers the other day, that people now in prison, you know, for certain offences, are eligible to enlist in the army. There was, at the end of the war, in 1945-46, a nasty little trick of magistrates who would say to some chap, you have a choice. You either join the army or we'll send you to prison. And we had, unfortunately, a draft of rather a lot more of those than I would have wished. Most of them, perfectly right.
What happened to these two fellows who did this?
I never asked. They left us to some reinforcement depot somewhere. Very much the worse for wear.
Were they fetched by the military police, or did you?
No, our own boys did it. Yeah. They were absolutely furious.
When you handed over the battalion eventually, what sort of things did you think necessary to say to the man who was taking over from you?
Well, I handed over to a chap who I'd known for years, Clooney McPherson, who had been a prisoner in 1940. He was a very, very efficient soldier. We were then down in the canals there.
Yes.
So it was not a handover in an internal security situation.
Yeah. But I mean, were there any things you consider, you know, what was the normal sort of briefing you would give to a and incoming?
Well,
commanding officer.
You see, it's very interesting. There isn't much briefing on a battalion handover. Actually, I think there is more nowadays. But in those days, there wasn't much. You know, okay, so he went round the quartermaster stores and looked at the books. He went round the pay section and looked at the books. You know, the secret files, all the rest of it. Punishment files. That's all he didn't know.
Did he know most of the...
He knew
officers?
A lot of the senior ones, yes. Of course he did, yes.
So he was
a pre-war regular soldier.
So he'd been familiar with some of the...
Oh, yes.
The people
very
in the
much so. And with the officers. His son, Rory, was one of the BBC's announcers 10 years ago. And I don't know, he left him, otherwise he'd be one of the top, you know, presenters of BBC News now to this day.
I think you went back to 3 years in the War Office.
Yes.
And you mentioned that you were GSO2 and that it was paperwork you were responsible for, infantry training.
Yes.
And from what you say, it seems that soldiers did about 20 weeks of basic training before going off to their...
About that was
yes,
true.
Yeah.
That was true.
Were they effectively trained by the time they joined their battalions, or was it up to the battalions to train them up?
Well, they were effectively trained in that they were tough, fit, they could use their weapons, they had a reasonable idea about what it was all about. But in the long run, only your fighting unit can really train people. If you sent someone out to the land general, he would want another 2-3 months of acclimatization or this before he would send him out on the ground.
I was going to ask what they could do in the way of minor tactics. Would
minor tactics, no problem. I mean, this is all theoretical stuff on a training area.
Yes. So would they be capable of doing platoon attacks effectively if they were... Once they've done their 20 weeks?
Well, I suppose you put them with a very well-organised platoon, yes. But, I mean, it was as good a training. There's a limit. You see, people today come up to me and say, what a pity that we don't have national service back. My goodness me, it did the country good. And I say, well, maybe. But I said, tell me, what are you going to do? Because if you're going to have national service, everyone's got to join. You can't have selective stuff. And what are you going to do after about 20 weeks? Where are you going to send your soldiers to? You know? If you don't give a national serviceman a proper job to do, he gets bored and then you're in big trouble. And I said, we don't have India, we don't have Malaya, we don't have Borneo, we don't have Hong Kong. So you'd have an awful lot of bored soldiers mucking about the countryside with nothing to do. Oh, but you know, they'd be in camps and under military discipline. And I said, yes, but that's not what the army is about. We aren't a social service. And sometimes they don't quite get that one. Mm. It was very interesting. You see, the people, if there were national servicemen who complained about national service, it was the people who never left this country. The people who went to the beastly places like Malaya and Korea thought they were doing a fine job.
Well, there was something going on.
Yeah, well, they were doing the job they were trained for.
Were there any changes, any significant changes in the syllabus of training or the way it was done during
yes.
that three-year period?
Yes, there was. Particularly in weapon training, which was done, the people who set the standard weapon training, of course, were the School of Musketry at Hythe. Well, in the old days, you gave a guy a rifle, and he polished it, he sloped it, he altered it, he ground it, and so on. And it was years before he was allowed to shoot it. And a chap called George Britton, who was my G1, said, look, can you give your grandson a bow and arrow? The first thing he wants to do is to go out in the garden and shoot something with it. And he said, we give soldiers a rifle. And, oh, damn, man, you know, he can't be trusted to shoot it until, you know, 6 weeks or so, by which time he's fed up with the bloody thing. And we totally revised the syllabus for small arms training. And that was done.